This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. After accidents, cancer is the second leading cause of death in children between the ages of 1 and 14. Conditions most commonly affecting children include leukemia, lymphoma, tumors affecting the bones or the neural systems, and these are difficult to treat. But survivorship rates are improving with modern medicine, yet more than 75% of survivors will likely suffer from at least one chronic health condition throughout their life. San Antonio is fortunate to be home to the Greehey Children's Cancer Research Institute, which is working to find more effective life-saving treatments for children struggling with childhood cancer. Why is treating cancer in children different than treating it in adults? Why hasn't there been more effective treatments and more investment in combating childhood cancer? And what do children and families do? How do they cope with a cancer diagnosis and treatment? If you or your family or loved ones been touched by childhood cancer, what do you want us to know about this? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guests this hour are Dr. Greg Aune. He's a physician, scientist, a pediatric oncologist at UT Health San Antonio, and a childhood cancer survivor. Peter Houghton is the director of the Greehey Children's Cancer Institute, and Lindsay Bindley is the mother of an 11-year-old child, Kennedy, who has muscle cancer. Let's get started. And so, Peter Houghton, can you tell me about childhood cancer? What is the extent of the situation with childhood cancer?
So childhood cancer in the United States accounts for about 12,500 new diagnoses every year in children up to the age of 21. It represents about a little less than 1% of total cancer. And the outcome of children with most diagnoses has improved dramatically over the last 50 years. In terms of the types of cancers, as you mentioned, they have cancers of the blood system, they have cancers of the brain predominantly. They tend to be cancers that are very different from adult cancers. Adults get predominantly carcinomas, which is tumors of epithelial tissues, whereas children get very different types of cancers with very different genetics.
So, Dr. Aune, when we say that it's less than 1% of overall cancers, that doesn't really give a really good idea of what we're dealing with here. It seems to be, I mean, not to sell short that statistic, it's important to know that, but it seems like for some reason this is significant. I mean, these are kids.
Right. And I would say the first thing is that if you're someone that's affected by cancer as a child or a parent of affected by childhood cancer, that 1% doesn't mean anything to you. For us, it's 100%. I think the other important part to drive home about children is they have an entire life to lead in front of them. So if you compare, look at another statistic, life years lost. So life years lost to pediatric cancer in the United States is about equal to life years lost for something like breast cancer, which accounts for a percentage-wise a lot more of our cancers, but the impact on a life is much more for a child when you're talking about someone passing away when they're potentially when they're in their elementary or school years or younger, and so the other component of it is just the outcomes that our patients have. So that survival rate that we often quote that everybody is beginning to learn a lot about across the country really doesn't give the whole picture. It gives few insights into the true outcome of the patient. So, unfortunately, our curative regimens that we now use are well known to cause a lot of tremendous health challenges for the patients. There was a study published in The Lancet earlier this month, which looked at the oldest cohort of survivors ever studied. And in that study, almost 100% of the patients that had survived childhood cancer had chronic health problems because of the treatments they took. And on average, each of those patients had four life-threatening or debilitating conditions that they were dealing with.
So does that mean that if a child has cancer and then they go through chemotherapy or something as a child, then throughout life, the chemotherapy may have prevented them from having strong bones or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I think you have to think about the way we treat cancer. We give systemic treatments. Chemotherapy goes throughout the body, and you know, essentially the strategy is to eliminate the tumor without having massive untoward effects on the patient. We can manage those nowadays, so patients can get through and survive that portion of it. But it's also affecting the normal organs during that process. It's just organs such as the heart, the bone marrow, the fat tissue, the brain are all affected by chemotherapy. It may not manifest during the treatment, but we now know that there's a cumulative effect that happens as people age past that early time of exposure. I can tell a little about my story about what happened to me to illustrate.
Yeah, you as a child were diagnosed, and how old were you?
So I was 16 years old, and I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which is a type of cancer that affects the lymphatic system.
So how did you, were you symptomatic, and you said, something's wrong with me, doc, and they said, you got cancer?
Yeah, so I went about 9 to 12 months with a lump in the right above my right clavicle. And it actually went to several doctors about that lump. And eventually, the day after Christmas, I saw a physician that actually took a chest x-ray. And on that x-ray, he showed me a normal x-ray. And then he put up what was my x-ray. And as he put that up, I knew it was probably not going to be good. And I had a fairly large tumor in my chest. And that's how I found out.
And you were 16 years old?
Correct, yeah.
And what did they tell you about what this meant for you?
Well, so I think that's something, you know, I look back now and what I was told I view very differently than I did at the time. So at the time, I was told, you have lymphoma, these are very curable, you just need to get to the treatments and everything's going to go back to normal. And what I've learned over the 27 years since then is cancer, especially in kids, is not, you treat it and you're done. It's a lifetime disease. And that's because of what comes after becoming cured. So throughout my life, I've been affected by a whole host of secondary health problems. The most dramatic, I would say, is I had open heart surgery about 9 years ago to replace my aortic valve and had a triple bypass at age 35. And that was because of one of the medicines that I took and some of the radiation I got to my chest.
Would early screening have been helpful? Is early screening something that we need to be talking about for kids?
For these late health complications, it's one of our major strategies now. So when I was a patient, this wasn't, I think, documented in a way that the medical practice had caught up with that. We now know of these problems. So we have specialty clinics designed to follow childhood cancer survivors. And we have one here at University Hospital where I practice. And the goal of that is to try to screen patients for their highest risk late effects based on their treatment exposures. And it's a lot of screening. We have a long ways to go in understanding, you know, how these health problems are caused by the drugs that the patients received, but we're beginning that work. And then the other side of the coin is by producing new drugs through research, hopefully we will have less late effects because of better targeted therapies that target the tumor and spare some of these normal tissues from the untoward effects.
We're going to keep talking about this. Our conversation today, what's being done to combat childhood cancer? Also, how are we helping kids after they survive the cancer and become adults and live a lifetime of chronic disease and in conditions? Give us a call. We want to hear your story. How has childhood cancer touched your family? The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about childhood cancer. In San Antonio, we have the Greehey Center, which is leading the way in finding cures and treatments for childhood cancer. We're asking people to tell their stories. We want to get a fuller picture of what it's like to have childhood cancer happening to you or someone in your family. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Angela is on the line. Angela, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
My son died of neuroblastoma, and that is cancer of the central nervous system. It took about 6 months for the symptoms to finally be diagnosed, and it was a rather large tumor. He was 4, which is well beyond what they consider cure rate. And it's an aggressive therapy. You're put on a protocol, and they tell you the cure rate is 6 months. And you're like, what do you mean? Well, that's your if your child is cancer-free for 6 months, we consider that cure, which should tell you that there's a very low likelihood of your child surviving that type of cancer. I just observed, I was at University Hospital in 1991, and on fourth floor, the doctors were scared because they were dealing with very upset parents, and the nurses were very good at doing what they could. But when with his cancer, he had to have vincristine, VP16, Cytoxan, and cisplatinum. And those drugs, basically, they didn't mean to kill him, but he died of renal tubular acidosis. But he also died of cancer. And it took me a very long time to not be angry with the doctors. And it was finally my husband who said, you know what? This is a birth defect, which they know, and I know childhood cancer is a birth defect. It's something in the body at birth, and that the doctors did not kill my child. Cancer did. And nature is random and unpredictable, and it is very hard on families. I saw families, I knew they weren't going to make it 3 months past the death of their child. I was lucky. I've been married for 35 years, and I had another child, but it was devastating. I was 28 years old when my child died. It was
so, Angela, can I ask you, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, and so tell me advice that you would give someone in your situation.
I would say be very, very, very realistic that when they tell you, and listen carefully, get a pen, get a paper, get a fresh set of ears that are not you, and have them listen to when they say, after the first round of chemo, there's a, and your child makes it past the first round of chemo, there's a 95% chance they'll make it to the second round of chemo. That does not mean that your child will be better. It just means they'll make it to the second round. In my son's case, it was a 100% chance he was going to die. I taught one student who had cancer. She had neuroblastoma. She was diagnosed when she was 4 months old. And when she was in fifth grade, she was still with us. But over the age of 18 months, neuroblastoma is always fatal.
And asking you again, I mean, that's practical advice, but what about your mental resiliency? Who did you lean on? What do you lean on in situations like that?
You know, I had a good friend who got me to a good psychiatrist, and the cancer, National Cancer Society, they are very good. They have people, they'll get you to people, Jewish Family Service. Lots of churches have service that'll put you through and get you the help you need. But mostly you have to forgive God, because you are so angry and you want to blame the doctors and you want to blame everybody, and it's really nothing you can do because it is a birth defect.
Okay. And Angela, thank you so much for the call. I really did appreciate you calling and helping us process this, and I'm sorry about the loss of your child. So, Dr. Ani, when you hear stories like Angela, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, just hearing that, that's something that, you know, me and my colleagues, I think we deal with this type of situation virtually every day. You go over to our hospital right now, and there's families going through that type of situation. Neuroblastoma is a terrible disease. You know, I think we're a little better off than we were in the early 90s, but we're nowhere near where we need to be.
When she says it's a birth defect, is that appropriate?
I don't know if accurate? I would use that language. I mean, I think what we do know about childhood cancer, A, we don't really know what causes it. So one thing that I think we always stress in talking about new parents is you didn't do anything to cause this, because it's really important that they hear that very early on. But then it's also talking a lot about how we really don't understand what causes childhood cancer. You know, these types of tumors that arise very early in children, and neuroblastoma is one of them. They most certainly are genetically driven, so something inherited that they are born with. We haven't clearly defined what those factors are at this point in time, and I think that's why the research has to continue, because as we do that, we'll begin to understand more and maybe uncover some of the causes, which we could then understand how to prevent them better. But unfortunately, we're not at that point right now. We're still kind of in the discovery stage. And that's, you know, why the research is so critically important, because I think all of us that do this envision a day where not only do you not have to worry about telling patients that they only have a 20 to 30% chance of survival, but that you can also tell them you're going to have a really good quality of life. And so the research, I think, is aimed at both of those types of situations.
So let me turn to Lindsay Bendeley. She is a mother with us this afternoon, and she has an 11-year-old child, Kennedy, who is dealing with muscle cancer.
And yes, sir.
So how's Kennedy doing today?
Well, earlier I got the message that she was going in for treatment. She had 102.5 fever when she went in. But my husband actually just texted me, and she has a 98.7 temperature. So I am very happy about that. But other than that, she's doing really well. She's a very positive person. And she's actually what gives me strength to see how she does.
And so is this, you're living text to text on about getting constant updates about conditions and how people are doing. And is that what it's like?
Pretty much. I take it day by day. It's just, or sometimes, sorry.
That's okay. So Peter Houghton, director of the Greehey Children's Cancer Institute, I mean, it's like that, right? I mean, this is the level of emotion and people dealing with things, and their children, the most vulnerable people, the one you want to take care of, are caught in this.
Right, and as Greg mentioned, you know, it's completely disruptive when you have a child diagnosed with cancer. It's a very long process, and there's lots of ups and downs. I mean, the children may do well at one point, then do badly at another, so it's a roller coaster ride for any parent. What I can say is, from a research perspective, is in response to your caller, that we do know that there are developmental blocks that lead to the formation of these cancers, and we're able to now subtype, say, neuroblastoma at a molecular level to understand the likely good actors and those who are going to do badly, and adjust the intensity of therapy so that those patients who have a high probability of a good survival perhaps have much less toxicity in the past. Greg is referring to the long-term sequelae from radiation and chemotherapy that is largely a consequence of treatment of patients back in the 1970s. And I think we've learned a lot from those experiences. But the objective is always to cure the child. And it's much easier to increase the intensity of therapy and have a high long-term survival than it is to take a therapy which is curative, say, in 90% of children who have Wilms tumor, and then reduce the intensity of that therapy at the risk that more of those kids will relapse and die.
How do we communicate to the child what is happening? Lindsay, I don't want to put you on the spot. And I
No.
know, how well does Kennedy understand what's happening to her?
She understood 100%. I want to say, at first I was kind of really nervous about telling her what was going on. My husband and I talked about it. We're like, well, maybe we'll have the doctors explain it to her, because they have more of an understanding than we did. But then luckily, Dr. Sigalski, who is Kennedy's primary doctor, his wife, they actually live in our neighborhood, so I communicate with her. And so she was telling me, you know, just prepare her, because I told her I was worried about not being able to tell her fully. But she told us, you know, she gave me some great advice, and was like, you know, well, you want her to know, because when she walks in and sees the other patients, she's just not going to know what was going on. But I mean, I could tell you she knows more about it than I do. She knows all the types of treatments that she's getting, and I'll be like, what did they say? And she'll be like, Mom, remember, like, it's this, this, and this. And so she's got it down better than I do. So she's got a better grasp than I think any of us.
How long ago was the initial diagnosis?
We didn't find out until June the 27th of her having sarcoma. And then right before 4th of July weekend is when we found out she had rhabdomyosarcoma.
And so what was happening leading up to that diagnosis?
Well, really back in May before Mother's Day weekend, I want to say the weekend before, she came home. We went to a birthday party. We came home and she was bawling. She said her ear was hurting so bad. So we took her to the doctor. She had an ear infection. I didn't think anything of it, normal ear infection. But later that night when she came into our room, she had a bump right below her ear, right behind her jawline. And so I thought maybe a swollen lymph node, something normal. Of course, I Google it because, you know, Google, you gotta Google everything. And we went back and forth from the doctor. I think we went to the doctor four times. One time I took her to the emergency room and they were like, well, our CT scan's down, so just take her to the doctor on Monday. It's probably nothing. Okay, no big deal. Then we went to an ENT specialist, middle of May, probably. And then from there, we went to see Dr. Miller at UT Health Center, also probably in June. And then that's when, towards the end of June, they referred us after doing a biopsy and a couple of scans.
And so when they told you, this is what we have, sarcoma, what is sarcoma, real quickly, doctor?
Sarcomas is a broad class or tumors that come from muscle and connective tissue and bone.
So there's a tumor,
right,
basically. And then y'all thought what? Did y'all figure this is how, you know, we're in trouble, or what did you think?
Once we figured out it was sarcoma.
Yeah.
I did know what everyone told me not to do, and of course, look it up. I definitely don't recommend doing that. But you know, I think once we figured out what it was more of a relief because, you know, hey, we know what to do instead of going bouncing back and forth and trying to figure out what we can do to help her and relieve some pain that she was having. You know, we could come up with a plan. Like, she could have, you know, it's treatments, surgery, radiation. It was actually, to me, you know, nice to have some sort of plan of something that I could see a difference in seeing helping her.
And so is Kennedy trying to do everything she can to maintain the life she had before the diagnosis?
For the most part, yes. She doesn't get to attend school this year because, you know, we're in and out of the hospital almost every other week. And she had 5.5 weeks of radiation. So that cut into the beginning of the school year. But she does have where her teachers come to her 2 hours a week. She loves it. She's my school queen. That, to me, was probably the hardest thing was, you know, you've got this kid who loves school so much, straight A's, and then she can't go to school. So I think that, to me, was the hardest part of everything. But, I mean, still AP classes, straight A's, awesome. Not bothering her.
Okay, we're going to hear more about Kennedy, her diagnosis, what's being done in San Antonio and around the world to combat childhood cancer. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source is going to continue after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. What's being done to combat childhood cancer? You can give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. How can San Antonio area families find relief from the stresses of a difficult diagnosis or grief after a loss? If you know an organization or an initiative that seeks to help, give us a call, 210-614-8980. Julia is on the line. And Julia, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. What really caught my ear a little while ago is I heard your guest talking about long-term care afterwards. My daughter was diagnosed just before her 16th birthday with osteosarcoma, and she spent an entire year. For 3 weeks out of every five, we were in the hospital inpatient. She was on five different chemos, which I can, as you can imagine, incredibly intense. She also had to have limb salvage surgery, so she's disabled now. But it was such a traumatic experience for her, and it wasn't so much the cancer. She was a real fighter. She was a In fact, the saddest part was she was the 11th fastest hurdler in the United States at the time this happened. And so her biggest problem after the fact was the loss of identity of who she was because she was an athlete. And so as a consequence, I have to fight with her every year to go and get her checkups. And then she has other issues, like she's recently developed this, I think it's an autoimmune of something, but first they told us she had Lyme disease, which it wasn't Lyme disease. And then they said, well, you've got rheumatoid arthritis. But the problem is there aren't doctors out there, it appears, and she even went to Sloan Kettering because she lived in New York, that understand kids who have been through these intense chemos and what it does to their body. And I know it does all kinds of things to their bodies, but there doesn't seem to be care providers out there. And then on top of it, I've got now a 27-year-old who doesn't want to have anything to do or even talk about the fact that she ever had cancer. So there's, with her, I've got two issues. I've got the psychological aspects of an adult child who doesn't even want to acknowledge that it was so traumatic for her that she doesn't even want to admit she ever had it. And then there aren't care providers there in terms of like primary care that know enough about it that they can direct her to the right places. So she's walking on, she's chronic pain. So she's walking around with all these horrific issues and trying to function in life. And
Julia,
it seems like there's nowhere to go.
Julia, thank you so much for calling in. Some great points there. So Dr. Greg Onney, you know, you're a childhood cancer survivor and a physician, scientist, pediatric oncologist at UT Health San Antonio. I'm sure what Julia is talking about really rings to you.
More than you know. You know, I've actually lived a lot of that same type of experience where going into doctors with various symptoms not feeling like they're taking you seriously from the standpoint that I was trying to tell them that these are likely linked to some of the therapies I took. And this is, you know, mainly based off of my own medical knowledge as I was going through my own training. Even that was difficult for me as someone that is in the field trying to convince doctors that I was seeing that there was a relationship between treatment and some of the health problems. The story we just heard is very common, actually. So common that I think it's one of the major issues that we have to solve in how we deliver healthcare to long-term survivors of childhood cancer. So if you look across the United States, the population of children that survive cancer that are now adults is expected to surpass 500,000 by the year 2020. We don't have a large number of multidisciplinary clinics that are focused on survivorship care in the United States. Here in San Antonio, we have one at the University Hospital that I see patients out with my partner, Dr. Shafkat Shah. We see approximately 300 patients a year at that clinic. But across the country, the problem is that there's really not good infrastructure to care for these patients. And what we do know from our long-term follow-up studies and some research done at St. Jude's and Memorial Sloan Kettering and other large institutions is that the generally accepted best model to care for those patients is in a multidisciplinary clinic with a, you know, pediatric oncology or oncologist with knowledge of, you know, late effects and how treatments can drive those in collaboration with some other subspecialties, perhaps cardiology, endocrinology, and some of the subspecialties that are more likely to affect the patients.
Does a survivor of childhood cancer, are they going to have trouble getting health insurance?
Major issue, and that's, you know,
it's a pre-existing condition.
In the context of, you know, all of the bait that's been going on this summer and even this week, that's a major consideration. I personally had issues with health insurance when I was early in medical school and I just moved to Texas. Fortunately, I got on my wife's military plan when I got married, and that took care of that problem. But that is a major consideration, and one that I think if you talk to parents and families that are affected by childhood cancer and they have survivors, that's one of the number one things that they're worried about. There was a study published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology recently that looked at the financial impacts of being a childhood cancer survivor. And not surprisingly, survivors were more likely to note worries about going bankrupt, reported higher out-of-pocket medical costs than comparison groups that weren't childhood cancer survivors. So this is a problem that we're going to have to deal with, and it's really one of the problems major problem is facing the field of pediatric oncology because we're getting better. We're saving more patients, but we have more survivors. So it's a new problem that we're beginning to have to deal with.
Lindsay Bendeley, mother of an 11-year-old Kennedy who has muscle cancer. Part of it, you're a full-time caregiver. You got to make sure that she shows up for the appointments and does all the right things. And then there's the stacking medical bills. That's got to be mind-blowing.
Yes. Luckily, though, I will say that we are blessed. Our work has put together different types of fundraisers. Our families have done fundraiser shirts, bracelets, GoFundMe accounts. And then on top of that, you know, luckily with my insurance, you know, my insurance, and then also Kennedy's dad. So she has two insurances. So with both insurance companies, it has really taken a lot of that pressure off as well.
So you see a lot of community involvement and churches getting behind people.
Our neighborhood has been absolutely amazing as well.
But not everybody has that.
No.
So when you don't have that level of support and you have a child who has a diagnosis, you wonder, you know, how are we going to figure out how we're going to pay these bills? And we also know that that in the Hispanic community, there's a lot of underrepresentation when it comes to doing specific research for childhood cancer. And so Peter Halton, director of the Greehy Children's Cancer Institute, can you talk about how that comes to bear?
Well, certainly. There certainly are underserved communities within South Texas. The Greehy is really putting a very large emphasis on Hispanic populations, trying to understand how their cancers may differ from the overall population, why they have, in many cases, for example, in leukemias, poorer outcomes. So this has been a particular focus of the Greehy.
And there's a tumor bank?
Well, we bank tumors, but what we are trying to do is to develop models of pediatric cancers, specifically from Hispanic patients. And what we do there is we create models by taking viable tissue, not banking it, but putting it into animals that have no immunity, expanding it, and then studying those tumors with respect to the genetics in terms of their changes that may be unique to those particular tumors, to expand those tumors in this case in mice, and then to viable preserve those tissues so they can be made available for researchers both in Texas and beyond.
So how does community involvement, or at least recognition that Hispanic heritage, genetic background comes to play or needs to be identified and promoted, that we have to be aware of this?
I think we have to be aware of it. I think there have been limited studies to date, and the Greehy is really making a major emphasis to try and understand these cancers and how they differ.
Can you talk about how San Antonio came to have the Greehy Center here?
The Greehy was the Children's Cancer Research Institute was originally funded through the tobacco settlement, and a foundation was set up. The institute opened in, physical plant opened in 2004, and in 2007, Mr. Greehy gave us a donation of $25 million to expand pediatric or childhood cancer research.
And as I understand it, Mr. Greehy doesn't just give out $25 million. I mean, he really gets involved. I mean, he really wants to see everything that's going on at a facility and make sure that this is going to, and then he continues his involvement.
Yes, in fact, Mr. Greehy was at the Research Institute this year. He's very much involved. He really wants to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to make sure that his funding is being spent in the right direction.
So that means something. The name Greehy isn't just him putting, he get your name on the door because you gave the money, but I think it also means something for other people who want to figure out how they can become active donors.
Yes, I think we talk about donors. I mean, obviously, Mr. Greehy has done an amazing service to us. But when we look at how pediatric cancer research is funded, it's very much underfunded through government agencies. There are a lot of private foundations that can contribute, and Greg can attest to that. But in terms of the national funding, we get about 4% of the National Cancer Institute budget. And as Craig mentioned, the lives saved through curing childhood cancer, even though it's a very small number of patients, is equivalent to that of breast cancer. So we're talking about potentially the outcome from pediatric cancer research is equivalent to maybe 30% of the NCI's budget.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation talking about what's being done to combat childhood cancer here in San Antonio and across the nation around the world. We invite you into our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We've got some calls on the board. We'll get them on the air when we come back when The Source continues. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about childhood cancer and what's being done to combat it. And the number to call in is 210-614-8980. Juan is on the line. Juan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Thank you for having me on the show. Appreciate it. I was calling in because this is very close to my own story, my own history. At 6 years old, I was actually diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And it happened, you know, after a weekend of like not feeling good, just being really fatigued and tired. And my mom actually thought, you know, I just had, you know, a common illness. So I skipped school on Monday, went to the doctors, got a blood draw. And later that evening, a physician contacted my mom and told her that I had acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and that was the beginning of, you know, the rest of my life, and everything's pretty much been very different since then. And so I wanted to share that with you guys today. I'm actually really thankful to still be here, and I think at 6 years old, you really don't know what's going on. And a lot of the things that they talk about, like for me, I was just sort of kind of along for the ride. And I think more than anything, I was wondering why my life was different than the other kids and why I had to do things differently. I became very interested, though, and started asking a lot of questions from my doctors. And I think one time my doctor found me having, you know, gone into his lab after being seen by the doctor and just in the clinic. And he found me looking at his microscope, and he actually showed me my own blood. And I became very interested in cancer, and he showed me my own cancer cells. And I think after that, I think I had a sparked interest in science and medicine. For me, the doctors kind of were a source of comfort during my illness. They kind of exuded this confidence, and they were kind to me and approachable to my family. And at the end of it, I think I just wanted to be kind of like those physicians and kind of bring that sense of calm to other families that are kind of the same position. So when I went off to do my undergrad at Baylor, I decided to be pre-med, and I did medicine, and I'm actually studying at the UT Health Science Center now as a second-year medical student. So just, a positive story of a survivor, I guess, that's out there. And I can definitely attest to the fact. Yeah, go ahead.
And so do you have conditions now as a result of your treatment that you received as a child?
At the beginning, I don't know, maybe I could have been maybe taller. Not anything big or obvious that I can tell you, but I could have been bigger. As I understand, I could have grown to be taller, because it was when I was six, I guess. I wasn't participating in sports. I wasn't eating as much as I should have been eating. You know, every chemotherapy makes everything taste bad, and it kind of kills the taste buds on your tongue. And I just I didn't like anything, and so. That was one way that was effective. They offered me growth hormone after my treatment was done, in my pre-pubescent stage. But I just I didn't want to do that. I didn't go for it. So I could be a little shorter. The other thing, I had radiation to my central nervous system, And they said that one of the effects of that could be a learning disability. So I actually got a series of tests, cognitive tests done on me to assess any effects on my cognitive abilities, and they diagnosed me with slower processing speed. So I've had some extra time at school to take tests, but since then, since high school and the first few years of college, I've been able to kind of join the rest of my classmates, and I no longer need extra time to keep up in class.
Juan, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate that. I've got another caller here. This is Scott. And Scott, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure when we're thinking about opportunities that we have in South Texas, and particularly San Antonio, is to talk about palliative care. So I had a son who was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder and died at about the age of 6 months old. So we had a long stay in the hospital, my wife and I, trying to figure out what was wrong with him, what was going on. And since he's then passed away, we've just learned that there's such a huge opportunity for San Antonio to grow in palliative care. So we started a foundation that's right now working with the Children's Hospital of San Antonio. It's named after my son. It's called the Gus Owen Stevens Foundation. We're hoping to one day build a palliative care center that can treat patients, because what a lot of people don't see is that, you know, patients that are coming in and for treatments, a lot of the time it's how are we treating the emotional well-being of our patients better? How are we not just treating the acute symptoms? How are all of the primary care doctors and all of the doctors that are caring for our kids, you know, how is it that they're communicating? So we're trying to build something that's dedicated to making hospital stays for these kids and people that are in long-term care situations, because it can have such a great effect on people's emotional well-being, which can have such a great effect on their physical well-being. And right now in South Texas and in Texas in general, it's an extremely underdeveloped system. There aren't really any systems, especially in San Antonio.
All right, Scott, thank you so much for the call. Thank you for that information. Now, we talked earlier about the fact that that cancer research, childhood cancer research, doesn't really get the funding level that, and then there's also the concern that commercial pharmaceutical research completely ignores it. Is that what happens, Peter Halton?
I think the pharmaceutical companies tend to be averse to investing in childhood cancer research, in part because there's a very small number of patients, so there's no market for that.
There's no profit.
There's no profit. The other is that there's a reticence to even have drugs tested in children, because if there is a bad outcome, it can derail a development program. So that's understandable. But I think what is really clear is that the causes of childhood cancer, the genetics or the epigenetics of childhood cancer, sometimes do not correspond to those that are the drivers in adult cancers. So one would have to develop completely new types of drugs for kids, and if there's no market, there's no incentive to do that.
So when you say the epigenetics, do you mean that there are outside forces like pesticides or something getting the genetics to act differently?
No, it's many of the childhood cancers are driven by genetic changes that lead to changes in how genes are expressed. So they're epigenetic changes. They're not necessarily per se a mutation in the genome. And we're starting to understand that pediatric cancers in general have very low mutation frequencies, but sometimes one of those mutations may be in a protein that causes the complete remodeling of the genetic expression of a cell. If you like, it's one hit can change 1,000 genes.
And is this something that can be tested for, screened for, maybe even prenatally?
Because it's such a rare disease, you know, you're talking about incidences of 1 in 100,000, you know, it's it doesn't become practical at this point. I think when there are non-invasive genetic approaches to doing this, then it, in the future it will be possible.
So, Dr. Greg Oni, you want people to what? What do you want people to know about childhood cancer? What is the main takeaway?
Well, I think the first thing is just to you know go back to some of the stories that you've heard today, that we've heard today, and just know that the toll that it can take on families and individuals still exists, and it needs to be fixed. The way that we improve survival even further and have a better quality of life for those that do survive, which is hopefully going to be everybody in the future, is through research, and that there's not enough funding for research, which is why we have to have a place like GRIHE, Children's Cancer Research Institute, which is one of the few places in the United States or the world whose academic mission is solely devoted to childhood cancer. And if you look at where our funding comes from for childhood cancer in the with respect to adult cancers, adult cancers get about 2/3 of their overall funding from private industry, pharmaceutical companies, and biotech. In childhood cancer research, that's effectively zero. So a place like GRIHE Children's Cancer Institute, the reason it's there is to fill that gap. And we need to put everything we have into that, because our ability to improve outcomes, health outcomes, and survival is solely dependent on places like GRIHE leading the way. Without that, we're not going to make any progress.
And Lindsay Bendeley and your daughter, 11-year-old Kennedy, dealing with the muscle cancer. I mean, everyone is pulling for you. And how are things going?
They're going good, actually. Like I said, she had just finished radiation, and talking to pretty much all the doctors at university, you know, you never know how any tumor or anything is going to react to radiation or any type of treatment. But I will say, so far, you know, she's having, you know, great success. You know, she definitely, within the first week, even after her first chemo treatment before radiation, you could tell a difference and stuff. Now that I can't see anything happening, you know, that it's nerve-wracking, but, you know, the tumor on her face, you know, you don't see, she looks back, her face looks back to normal, smiles
awesome.
And happy.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.